Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. And welcome to the New Books in History podcast on the New Books in Network. We're here today with Jesse Sponholz, professor of history and director of the Roots of Contemporary Issues World History program at Washington State University in beautiful Pullman, Washington. And we're going to talk today about his penultimate book, The Convent of Wesel, The Event That Never Was and the Invention of Tradition, first published in 2017 by Cambridge University Press and out this year, 2020, in paperback. Hello, Jesse.
Hi, Anna. Good to talk to you.
Oh, it's great to talk to you. How are you doing? Have you wrapped up your semester?
The last papers come in today from my Roots of Contemporary Issues class and my history seminar, so I'll be grading after we finish talking today.
Oh, thank you for taking time out when you just had a pile of papers land on you. That's fun to
think about this book and to talk about this book with you.
Okay, wonderful. All right, so let's get right into it. My first question is always about placing the current work in your academic intellectual kind of trajectory. And this one makes perfect sense. It sits right in your sweet spot of Reformation history. But I'm curious about what made you decide to take on the Convent of Wesel.
Yeah, it was really, I never intended to write a book about it, but it came out of my first book. My first book was called The Tactics of Toleration, and it was about migrant communities from the Low Countries who moved to a German city along the Rhine River and how they learned to coexist as refugees in this new environment. And one of the things that was really interesting about the book is that everything that I thought about this city didn't seem to match with what everything that had been written about the city told me I should be finding. So there was a gap there. And at the same time, there was also this mystery that I learned about in the course of that research, the mystery of this important event that was supposed to have happened in this city during the period that I was studying it. And I sort of set it aside for a long time, but I came to see after starting to write, I decided I had enough expertise. I really had a duty to the experts in this field who really cared about this event, a mystery about which has existed for the last 300 years. And I had a duty, given what I knew about the topic, to really write what I knew and offer my perspective on the topic. So I started writing an essay, and as I came to realize that the puzzle itself, this curious little puzzle about this event that had no evidence to support it ever existing, despite the fact that it was rife in hundreds and hundreds of books and articles and other publications, and I decided that it was not only interesting in itself. Because it would have been the most comprehensive meeting of Reformed Protestant leaders in the 16th century without any evidence that it took place. That's an interesting puzzle. But the puzzle itself was a symbol of a larger research question, which is, how is it that I could, for instance, go to study this place and all the scholarship on it is wrong? Like, what is the gap between the 16th century, the messy 16th century that I was learning about, and the categorical, the ways in which historians have described it using categories of national and religious and confessional boundaries that I couldn't find. So I began to investigate. I began to see it as not only as a mystery, but also as a kind of contribution to help understand how we can see through some of those categories to try to understand the 16th century on its own terms.
All right. Normally at this point, I have a lot of preliminary questions about sources and historiography. But with this book, I think the best way to go at it is just jump in and tell the story, and then that will lead us there. So let's do that. Let's start with like part one, which you title Solving the Mystery. And this is really clever, right? Because doing history of this sort, like the sort that takes place in archives and small libraries, is often compared to solving a mystery. And historians famously love mysteries. But you take that to a whole new level, though, in your introduction, in which you discuss focusing on, and I'm quoting here, understanding who had the motive, means, and opportunity to create such a document. And it's clever because it sets up this idea that there's something to solve here, and that's not necessarily uncovering a truth so much as, or perhaps uncovering a little bit of a crime. I think that's fascinating. But so let's start at the beginning. Can you tell our listeners about the Convent of Wesel? What happened according to the story, and what was the document it produced?
Sure. So I can start with the standard historical narrative, which is that in November, early November 1568, a group of several dozen, say 50 some odd, leading Protestant reformers from the Netherlands had fled from the Netherlands and met in secret in this town along the Rhine River to organize a new church for the Netherlands, and as a rebellion was taking place, and they were looking forward to implementing this new church and replacing the Catholic Church that had that was the dominant church at the time, and they met together and they wrote down articles for this. For this new church, and then in the subsequent years, they refined and they used these 122 articles as a kind of model for church building. And when rebel leaders would take over the northern part of the Low Countries, which mostly are the lands that today we call the Netherlands, they would use these articles as a kind of model for building their church. So they built and imagined their church while they were in exile as refugees, and once they had freedom to establish their own church, they used that model then to establish the Dutch Reformed Church, which became the state church of the official church of the Dutch Republic. The problem is that there's no evidence that the meeting happened, like I said before, which created for me a kind of mystery. What is it that happened? And the centerpiece of the mystery is these 122 articles. Which are real. They were really written, and they were, as far as I can tell, written about on November 3rd, 1568. So I set about to solve who exactly wrote them, why they wrote them, and who signed them, and because there were these signatures on the document as well, who signed them and why they signed them, and it was really a kind of mystery. You know, for most of us in our first books or for many of our projects, doing research can be not so much like a mystery, but like a painting or something, where you take a look at all the evidence that exists around a topic, and you paint a picture of what you see. But this was different because there was often big gaps in the evidence, and the archives weren't. I couldn't just go to an archive and say, you know, what do I see? There's this mystery, and I had to sort of ferret out the mystery. And the center point, so I end up focusing the first part of the book on, the first chapter is on time. So the understanding the political and military events sort of from a month to month and sometimes day to day basis to try to understand what's happening, when this document was produced. How we can understand the context of when it's taking place. And there's a kind of subtext to this, which is that two other scholars have decided that the solution to the mystery was that the meeting must have taken place a couple years before or a couple years after. And so I wanted to make sure that I addressed their concerns as well. And then in chapter two, then I trace down the author. And I do this by contextualizing the content of the articles, what they wrote, and look at who was writing at this time, who would have these interests, and try to contextualize all of what they wrote. So in chapter three, I then look at the signers, and I trace down as much as I can about all of the signers of this document as I can, and try to figure out where they were, why they may have written. It turns out that many of them were not supporters of many of the principles in the document. So there was a kind of mystery about that as well. And then the last chapter looks at what happened after the document was signed. And I demonstrate that that really the document turned out to be kind of a flop, and it was tucked away in an archive and not really dealt with. So it was not actually the important document that it's been often claimed to be.
Okay, so there's no gathering
right.
as such.
Right, yeah, exactly. So there seems to be an initial meeting of three people on November 3rd, 1568. The guy who wrote it, I believe, is a guy named Petrus Dathenus, who in Dutch history is well known as a famous translator of Psalms from the 16th century. Petrus Dathenus, I think, was the person who wrote it. He was, at the time, pastor in a small town in the Palatinate, in the mid or upper Rhine area. And he seems to have been the only person that I can identify who actually was moving around at this time intentionally. And the articles seem to map onto his intellectual trajectory. They seem to be promoting the kind of church he was leading in this town called Frankenthal in the Palatinate, and not the kinds of churches that other religious leaders of his movement in Emden or in London or in underground in Antwerp, the kind of churches they were leading. So it seems to be that he's the one that's behind writing these documents, and he's moving it around. So rather than having a big meeting, what happened was that Dathenus takes this document and he brings it to Wesel, and he has people sign it in Wesel, but not at the same time. It seems to be over the course of many months. Some of them weren't in Wesel on November 3rd. Others were never in Wesel at all, but maybe had someone sign for them in their place. And after Wesel, he had run into somewhere between the Palatinate and Wesel, he ran into Hermann Modet, who's another leading reformer of the time, who happened to be visiting Geneva on a completely separate matter. But it seems to be they were traveling together and arrived in Wesel, at which point Dathenus returns to Frankenthal, and the document ends up moving with Modet first to Emden on the Lower Saxon coast near the Dutch border in East Friesland, and then to London, to the Dutch church in London, where in each place we can identify signers as having signed in those places.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the aim? What's the point of this? What does our author intend to happen?
Yeah. Yeah, so we can really help understand if we look at the day-to-day and week-to-week political and military context of the moment. So it just so happens that a few weeks before the document was signed, William of Orange had just invaded the Low Countries. William of Orange, the leader of who had just come out as the leader of the rebellion against the Habsburg authorities in the Low Countries, had just invaded with a very large army. And not so far from Wesel on the Dutch border, he had mustered at Duisburg and then moved over from in the southeast of Low Countries, and he was engaged in a long kind of cat and mouse game with the Duke of Alba, who had also a large army, and the two of them instead of attacking Orange, Alba just followed Orange's troops around, so he was trying to really wear them down, hunger them. Before he attacked them, he had far fewer troops, but they were far more experienced. So his plan was to sort of wear Orange's troops down. So this war or battle that's taking place is really a kind of a long, dragged out battle with very little deaths. And in the meantime, a lot of people who support the Reformation are really excited that Orange has a really high chance of winning. And Orange had aligned himself with supporters of religious compromise. Including some people of Dathenus' own church who were willing to compromise with Lutherans and build a model of peaceful coexistence that would look like the Peace of Augsburg in the Holy Roman Empire, that allowed both Catholics and Protestants to coexist. And some people like Dathenus had been opposed to that, to Orange's politics. So it seems that what Dathenus is doing is trying to come up with a kind of pressure document to get as many people as possible to sign a kind of alternate model that doesn't align itself with Lutherans or the Peace of Augsburg, but instead aligns itself with the Palatinate, the Reformed Protestantism in the Palatinate and the Elector Palatine, who is more clearly Reformed. And so what he's doing is sort of drafting this thing up and passing around to get as many people to sign as possible. One of the points that I found interesting about studying this is that no one had really even thought about this, but there's a whole series of blank pages that were never signed. And it seems to be that he imagined he might get many more signatures than he ever got. But it turns out while the document's arriving in London, Orange does indeed run out of money to support his troops, and his troops are in retreat, and they fall back into France, and they end up retreating to Strasbourg. So by the early part of January 1569, Orange shows up and says, I didn't make it, and his failure has become known. But so any effort to try to create a new church becomes kind of a moot point, and the document is set aside at the Dutch-speaking church in London, called Austin Friars, and that's where it lays for the next 50 years.
Okay, and which takes us now to kind of, I think we can move forward to the kind of the afterlife of this document. Okay, so I think we understand why it doesn't get any play right away. There's no place to set out a Dutch church, really, at least not at home. So then, let's move on to kind of part two, creating the mystery. So the first two sentences of this part, the first two sentences of chapter five, up until this point, the book is focused on unraveling the mystery of the convent of Wesel. The central problem, as I described it in the introduction, has been the gap between the lack of evidence that such an event ever happened and the tenacity of the idea that an event with considerable influence must have happened. Now, starting here, you proceed to explain how the idea of this event with considerable influence was codified and cemented in public memory. So the first thing that happens is the manuscript reappears and historians start to write about it. So how does that happen? Like, can you comment on the implotment of the National Synod of Wesel?
Yeah. Okay. The story, as I said, it just sort of sits and is irrelevant until 1618. Now, what happens in 1618... is that in the Dutch Republic, in the early Dutch Republic, there's a deep constitutional conflict that nearly pushes the country into war. It's a conflict that is in part political and in part religious, but critical to the conflict between so-called remonstrants and counter-remonstrants, two religious factions in the Dutch Reformed Church. Critical to that is that the remonstrants want to demonstrate autonomy to be able to make decisions about requiring certain kinds of theological principles of their church, separate from the state. And for that purpose, therefore, they have an interest in telling the story of the Dutch Reformed Church not as being connected to the state, but being founded before the state, right? It's in that context that the meeting is happening and this conflict is really tense. And while this is happening, the pastor of the Dutch church in London, a guy named Simeon Rautink, he hopes to go to the meeting when the counter-remonstrants ultimately win in 1618. He hopes to go to this meeting to celebrate. He's a counter-remonstrant himself, to celebrate the victory of the counter-remonstrants and of Orthodox Calvinism in the Dutch Reformed Church. Ultimately, he's not allowed to go because the James I, King of England, doesn't want to suggest that any pastor in England is under a foreign power. But Rautink hopes to go, and in preparation to go, he prepares a book that explains how all explains the principles of all the organizing meetings of the Dutch Reformed Church, and it's in that context he finds and uses this Dathenus's article, the 1568 articles, which he calls the National Synod of Wesel. Now, he does that because the meeting that's about to happen is being called the National Synod of Dordrecht. in 1618. So he tells a story that presents the National Synod of Dort as one of a series of six national synods. So it's part of a continuum. It's not something new, but something very old. And in his model, something so old that it goes back before the Dutch Republic was even founded. And so the National Synod of Wesel, the way he describes it, tells a story of continuity of the independence of Orthodox Calvinism, of Orthodox Reformed tradition within the Dutch Reformed Church before, so as if it wasn't new in 1618, but went back to 1568. So at the time, very little people gave it much credence. Of course, as I said, there wasn't much evidence. And even Rautink, who writes a history of the Reformation a couple years later, makes no mention of this. So at the time, it actually plays very little. It does not play. He never goes. This treaty he writes, Harmonia Synodorum Belgicarum, doesn't get much play. And that's a kind of a minor part of the story. But then it gradually picks up. It gets picked up by other supporters of Orthodox Reformed tradition in the Dutch Republic in later years to make similar kinds of arguments that Rautink was made. It gets picked up by one of these, Johannes Heisius, one of these who makes copies of the original document, which had been moved to The Hague, and he makes copies of it, including sending a copy to Germany. Where church historians then would pick it up in Germany. And it was the use of this document and stories about the document in later years that began to the spread of the idea of the National Synod of Wesel. Now, in the Netherlands, the idea remained a kind of national story. It became one about the Dutch national tradition, that somehow Calvinism was inherent to the Dutch Protestant tradition and therefore to the Dutch Republic. And so therefore used by supporters of that tradition. Meanwhile, people who oppose that position tend to ignore it entirely, even those that knew about the evidence. In Germany, they tend to drop the word national, so that it's not the story they tell is not of a national synod of Wesel, but one of a synod of Wesel that they use to tell a story about their local church and the origins of their local church dating back to 1568.
Okay. And so this takes us up, basically, this takes us a little bit farther. We've got about, what, a century now?
Right, yeah.
75 years.
That chapter ends with, in 1768, with the 200-year anniversary of the event, which is not a huge celebration, but there's a history is written by a guy named Adrianus Ravensander, who explains the history of this event, and that's how I end that chapter.
All right. And there is a story of this intersects with the kind of the greater story of the Enlightenment as well. Okay. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. That's super. That's where I was going with Ravensander. So meanwhile, in the Dutch Republic, right, the Dutch Republic is like a center of Enlightenment thinking and radical Enlightenment thinking. And one of the ways in which church historians respond to the Enlightenment is by developing and embracing writing church histories as a way of demonstrating the traditions that they share in their faith. But the problem emerges that the more and more they need to provide proof and evidence, that the use of footnoting and documentation to demonstrate the quality of their argumentation, the harder it is to demonstrate that the Synod of Wesel, the National Synod of Wesel, ever happened. And that's why Schravensander's book is so important. So what Schravensander does in his book, and he wrote it on the 200-year anniversary, and he gives a kind of detailed argument. He's the first author to identify the problem with the evidence. And so he openly admits the problem with the evidence, but then he goes systematically through the evidence to demonstrate why, in fact, despite the fact that there's no corroborating evidence, the event must have happened in the way that it has long been told. He rests his argument on a series of points, some of which are pretty weak. He argued that most of his arguments rest from our arguments from silence, right? That there was reasons for people to have maintained their silence because it was dangerous. Nobody wanted to threaten the city of Wesel because it was supporting these criminals. If they had support from the Duke, it might cause international scandal. These arguments from silence don't have much to support them. He built up an argument that supported the idea of the National Synod of Wesel using specious arguments, but enough footnotes and enough documentation that he could convince skeptical readers that probably it something really did happen. And so one of the things that happens because of that, he has all the apparatus of a scholarly argument. He has footnotes and documentation, careful reading of documents, but not a sound argument. But one of the things that happens as a result is many people then simply use his conclusion without investigating the quality of his evidence in subsequent years, use his conclusion as a kind of an easy way to reinforce the idea that the event had happened all along. So rather than the rigors of the Enlightenment undermining conclusions about the National Synod of Wesel, the rigors of the Enlightenment, the trappings of Enlightenment scholarship, ended up reinforcing the idea of it, in effect, allowing it to spread into secular scholarship, which it did in the 19th century.
So before we get to the 19th century, which is where we're going next, I find that a kind of a historically interesting, right? That's a little bit, that's maybe irony, right? This apparatus kind of further cements this fictional event in history. But what else, why do people want to believe this?
Well, you know, different people have different reasons. And that's also part of the interesting story, both in the 18th and to the 19th century. Like I said, people who support Orthodox Reformed Orthodoxy within the Dutch Reformed tradition want to believe it because it tells a story of the Dutch Church being founded in Orthodox Reformed principles supported by Dathenus and not by supporters of the kind of compromise that Orange was encouraging. So it suggests those principles go back deeper in time, and of course, the longer in time that people can find a truth, oftentimes the more authority they assign that truth. But also, as I said before, the fact that it was independent from political authority, that church leaders were able to do this and have the authority, felt like they had the authority to do this without any compromise with politicians, was useful in their rhetorical struggles against politicians who wanted to regulate the church. So in that's why up until the 18th century, really, it was only those people who were really, really attached to the idea of the National Synod of Wesel. The other people who discuss it, the counter-remonstrants or supporters of or other opponents of the Orthodox Reformed, they mention it, but they tend to emphasize its lack of importance. And sort of poo-poo it a bit. And then in the 19th century, some of them actually start embracing the idea as a way of demonstrating that Calvinism or the Reformed Orthodoxy was a foreign invention to the Dutch Republic, so that Calvinism is something that's not native to the Low Countries. They embrace the spirit of Erasmus, this Desiderius Erasmus, the famous Dutch humanist. And they see Erasmus as embodying the tolerant, broad-minded spirit of the Dutch culture, and see the Convent of Wesel as an example of how foreign influences could threaten that.
Yeah, Calvinism is a foreign invention is... Okay, that's lovely. All right, so in the 19th century, though, this gets a much broader appeal, right? That's part of the story. So there's a much broader appeal. We leave these Reformation and Reformed ministers and go into kind of a broader public appeal. What's happening there?
The story is in part one. This is where the German part of the story becomes really important, but the Dutch part of the story really changes. So a couple of things that are happening. One is three things are happening at once or simultaneously. One is the development of secular academic culture and the production of massive amounts of new scholarship of higher quality, and so new academic departments, new universities being founded and expanded, so that there's a whole waves of new sort of memory cultures. And in the Netherlands, a lot of that memory culture centers on the founding documents of the founding of the Republic. But the other thing that's happening in the Netherlands is a real culture war that's taking place. And one of the interesting things that I uncovered that I don't think I'd ever really thought about this before is that one of the leading sets of documents from this period that historians have long used is a collection called the Werken der Marnixvereniging, the Works of the Marnix Society. And I'd never really thought about what that was when I was writing my first book, but I came to explore it because it was the Werken der Marnixvereniging, the last of these works that published the most influential copy of this of the articles of the Synod of Wesel. And so I began exploring that. And one of the things that I learned was that the guy who was most responsible for the Marnixvereniging was a guy named Abraham Kuyper. Now, I grew up in America and I was not familiar with Abraham Kuyper, but once I started asking questions, I came to learn that in fact he was extremely important and still a touchstone of cultural division in the Netherlands because of his views. He was a supporter of what was called Neo-Calvinism in the late 19th century, and he promoted a worldview that saw the origins of freedom and not in democracy or in the principles of the Enlightenment, but rather in Calvinism. And so he began a project in the late 19th century. He began a project to promote the history of the 16th century refugees, Reformed refugees, as the kind of founders not only of the Dutch Republic and the Dutch Reformed Church, but of modern liberty itself. And it was in that context that he founded the Marnix Society, named after one of these refugees who signed the document that I was studying. While he would later get involved in higher level politics and became the prime minister, his society would publish thousands and thousands of pages of documents, many of which are incredibly useful to me as a scholar. But one of which was also the modern edition that has found its way into so many 20th century books. So all of that's happening in the Netherlands. Meanwhile, in Germany, the Prussia has taken over in this part of Germany, and starting at the 100-year anniversary the 300-year anniversary of the Reformation, the Prussian king starts promoting a kind of ecumenical Christian church that would bring all the Protestants, the Lutherans, and the Reformed together under a single umbrella. And in places like the area around Wesel, where they had a long tradition of supporting Reformed Protestantism, they pushed back on this by celebrating their distinct traditions of Reformed Protestantism, their links that were closer to the Netherlands than to Berlin. And so it was these people who ended up pushing for the importance of the Synod of Wesel in the 19th century in Germany, because it offered them a kind of model for how their tradition did not come from Berlin, but it was rooted in their deep connection through the Rhine River and the Low Countries next door. And it was this group of people who ended up organizing the 300-year celebration of the Convent of Wesel, which took place in Wesel in November of 1868. And it was this huge celebration in the city. Dutch leaders of the Dutch Reformed Church, leaders from around the Rhineland churches came. There were parades and events. And group meals. There were speeches from leading theologians of the day. The king of the Netherlands. King of Prussia sent representatives. There were military orchestras. So there was this elaborate celebration of this event in 1868 that sort of marks the end of the kind of romantic nationalism, both in the Netherlands and in and then it's just sort of regionalism in the Netherlands, in the Germany, that marks the end of what I see as the high point of this historical memory of the Synod of Wesel.
So what's the state of the debate now? Take us to the present.
Yeah, well, in the late 20th century, two scholars, I mean, there was more and more. So what happened, let me back up a little bit. So what happened in the 20th century is that because increasingly scholars began to recognize the weakness of the evidence. And so instead of referring to the National Synod of Wesel, scholars began to refer to it as the Convent of Wesel. The Weseler Convent was the German originally. Convent, just a meeting, comes from a Latin word for meeting. So it's just I began to describe it as the meeting at Wesel. In the late 19th and early 20th century, there's about 5 or 8 different words that get used to describe the meeting. And gradually, the Convent of Wesel, het Convent van Wesel in Dutch, or the Weseler Convent in German, begin to be standard. And oftentimes, scholars would put it in inverted commas or scare quotes to recognize that there really is not much evidence for it, but they continue to use it in the exact same way as if it were founding, as if these articles were a founding document for either the Dutch or the German Church, depending on which side of the border they were on. In the late 20th century, two scholars. One was an archivist in the Netherlands, a guy named Jan Pieter van Doren, and another one was a church historian in the Netherlands, called Ove Boersma. Jan Pieter van Doren is now deceased. Boersma is still active in the Netherlands. They both put together attempts to solve the mystery by addressing the problem of the signers. And really, the focus of them, as well as other scholars who address this problem, has centrally been about trying to figure out a way to explain how all of these people could have been in one room at the same time to sign this document. And so, in order to do that, both van Doren and Boersma proposed theories that the problem was that the document had been misdated. And maybe even the location of the document, a false location given on the document, so that if we put it in a different place, in a different time, maybe we can figure out how all these people could be in one place at once. And so van Doren presents the argument that it must have been in Antwerp in 1567. Boersma suggests that it probably was in Wesel in 1571, not 1568, and maybe it had started being signed a little further west, and then was traveled around a little bit after it was signed in Wesel. And I sort of walk through the problems with this in the book, with each of these theories in the book. And I think that the central problem, as I came to understand it, was that they were trying to get everyone in the same room. But if you abandon that idea that they're all in the same room, the problem becomes relatively simple. You look where they were at this time, and there's a relatively straightforward trajectory of the document moving from Wesel to Emden to London. And so that's sort of the narrow question of where what actually happened. I suppose the historiographical situation at this point is, I've offered a counter to van Doren and Boersma that offers a what I think is a much more compelling and evidence-based conclusion that solves many of the problems that they had.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see this debate, because I think your argument is just very convincing. I'm converted, and I can't imagine anyone isn't. And it just makes so much sense, and it works. But I did check the Wikipedia article, and it's unclear. You're in there, but it's not coming down on anything. And as we know, that's, you know, an important important marker there. Anyway, so you do a couple important things here. Like, you tell the story, right? And you do your historical analysis here, but you also talk about the process of telling a story, the process of how of making the history around this event, the story of the creation of the story. And I'm wondering, You know, that's new, and that's requiring you to think as an historian on this meta level. And do you feel like you're going to take that with you? Was that kind of a transformative process?
Well, first on the Wikipedia thing, I do hope to write an article on the afterlife of this story on Wikipedia in subsequent years. But I need to wait for more evidence and more debate. But as for your question, in the conclusion of the book, I set about to do two things. One is to think about what it is a historian does when they walk in and look at a source. And I talk about the six versions, extant versions of the document, and how differently they're archived, and how the archival context shapes what kind of conclusions a historian might be able to make about that document, even though they're actually the same text. And that deeply shaped my thinking as a historian, because I came to think about archival context in a really much more profound and systematic way. Now, professional historians understand, and I know you have this experience too, that we know that archives shape how a user of the archive makes sense of documentation. We know that archives are not neutral. We're not naive when we go into archives. But as I thought about this project, I began to be much more systematic, and by looking at just how one document is archived, be much more systematic in how I approach my evidence, and also to be more systematic and thoughtful about how I interact with archivists and tend to my relationships with archivists. I think before I worked on this book, I confess I had sometimes a transactional relationship with archivists and librarians, and I came to realize how, in writing this book, how problematic that was. And so I'm not only more systematic in my archival criticism than I used to be, but I'm also much more systematic about how I build relationships with colleagues who are archivists or other kinds of record keepers, librarians, and other kinds of people. In addition, in the conclusion, I reflect on the who I am as a person, my values, my background, and reflect also on the ways in which they shape how I might be interpreting this event. And I do that rhetorically as a way both of confessing that if I'm critiquing other people's interpretation and contextualizing them, I need to do that to myself as a responsible scholar, but also to appreciate the extent to which the inheritances that we sometimes can't see about the past are inheritances that are in the archive. They're inheritances that are in libraries, but they're also inheritances that are in ourselves that we need to be able to confront. And so those lessons are meant to help readers who might appreciate history and really appreciate, want to be curious about the past, but really help them understand the complexity, the deep complexity that goes into telling a historical narrative that's about the archives and the evidence, yes, but also about the centuries that preceded it and the inheritances, some of which are visible and some of which are really hard to see, the inheritances that shape how we make sense of the past, what kind of narratives we assign to the past, and how we can use the past to drive us into the future.
It's so important how we can use it and how it can really kind of cloud us as well, right? It's really important. And I think this is a book that people should read for a number of reasons, but other historians really need to read this and think about
one of the things that I found so interesting about this book is some of the leading historians of that I grew up admiring and wanting to model myself on, they were using the Convent of Wesel in the same sort of easy way. I'll put it in air quotes and just continue to use it in this way, even though they know perfectly well that there's a problem. And they are some of the most sophisticated thinkers that I have ever met. And so the problem is not an easy one. It's a really difficult one, and one that I think is worth all of us grappling with.
Yeah, and there's something we like to believe, I think, despite all of us are now postmodernists to some degree, I think we like to believe that there is a truth there, there's an event, and we'll just get at that, and we won't be affected by 300 years of whatever. You know this in my field, maybe a little bit more about the idea of the Renaissance as an idea or something. But and that's ridiculous. And there's no reason for us to expect that as historians, we stop being subject to the forces of history. But
that's right. That's right. And yet at the same time, the solution to the problem, as I understand it and describe it in part one of the book, is a real sort of commitment to 19th century historicist principles, right? Go back to the evidence, contextualize that evidence. And what I'm doing differently than other people is I'm developing a much more, who've studied this particular problem, is developing a much more broad and rich body of contextualization of evidence around this one piece of this one set of documents than other scholars had before. But it's not the solution is not to abandon historical research because it's all problematic. The solution is to double down, I think, on the historicist principles that had been developed that we've all been taught.
Mm-hmm. Well done. Yeah, absolutely. So I've taken up a good bit of your time here, and you do have that stack of papers. But before we go, so this is a 2017 publication, and you have a new one this year, yes?
That's right, I do.
You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, this book is, it's called Ruptured Lives, Refugee Crises and Historical Perspectives. It came out this year with Oxford University Press. And it's a much broader book than the Convent of Wesel book. It looks at different kinds of refugee crises and moments in world history. And it attempts to try to understand the relationship between the deep assumptions that come to embed societies and individuals about what kinds of people ought to be living in what kinds of spaces on this planet and how those deep assumptions come to underpin some of the most dramatic and refugee crises in the past. And I begin the book with the refugee crisis that's the focus of my own research in the Reformation and the ways in which the idea of Christendom falls apart in this peninsula of Eurasia that we today call Europe, as the principle of Christendom falls apart, it's really driving a lot of the tumultuous disorder that's shaping the kinds of lives that I described in my previous book, The Convent of Wesel. But then I step back in this book and I think about the broader kinds of similar kinds of crises and collapsing assumptions that are shaping a lot of the other refugee crises in world history. So this is a much broader project. I'm now currently working on a new book that goes back to the 16th century and tries to retell the history of the refugees of the 16th century with the lessons of the Convent of Wesel book in mind. So try to throw away the kinds of assumptions that shape our understanding of that period, and instead rebuild a new narrative of that period.
This is very exciting work. Yeah, we'll talk about discussing Ruptured Lives for sure. And I'm looking forward to your next work as well. That's ambitious. These are a lot of important and big projects that you're doing. Congratulations on that. I mean, perhaps, you might want to rest a little, but whatever.
Well, I really like talking about important ideas, and I find a lot of meaning in it. So I'm going to keep on writing. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, that's the other thing that I think is, if you aren't one of us, it's hard to understand. Is it's just the archives are fun. It's so exciting. Being an historian is so cool. It's great to just go out and be an historian. All right, so thank you so much, and good luck with your day, and we'll talk again soon. Ciao.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Yana.
Thank you.
Tozin.
Tozo.